Episode 17 of the Bloodstream Podcast is brought to you exclusively by Shire. And for that we say...
Thank you, Shire.
Thank you, Shire. Hello, and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast, episode 17, October 16th, 2017. I'm Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
On this episode, we discuss Factor Revolution, Bloodstream Media's new three-part podcast series covering the history of treatment in hemophilia. Natalie takes us through the five things all new moms, or moms of newly diagnosed children, need in our Like segment. Factor Revolution producers Ryan Geelan and Seth Kirshner introduce themselves and give us a look behind the work in our Share segment. I take us through a new opinion piece and a newly introduced piece of legislation on the topic of medical marijuana and cannabis use for pain management. And finally, sports writer and hemo dad Dan Levy, perhaps better known as the dad of Iron Max, shares his perspective on media, community, and much more during our sit-down segment. That's right, you're getting all of that and more on episode 17.
Welcome to Bloodstream.
A couple things have happened since the last time we recorded an episode, including the defeat of the Graham-Cassidy healthcare bill. No. It's kind of old news by now, but nonetheless, that wasn't
easy. Old news, but good news.
Old news, but good news, and also that is far from a button on protecting the Affordable Care Act and aspects of healthcare as we know it, because since then there has been a proposal for tax reform that threatens to cut $450 billion, that's
with a B,
from Medicare and scale back dramatically support of Medicaid. So just because repeal and replace under that reconciliation September 30th umbrella is over, it doesn't mean there aren't other attacks on healthcare to be aware of. So congratulations to us, but stay alert, stay aware of what's going on. Keep in tune with us and with NHF and HFA about action alerts because we're not done defending healthcare. Speaking of, open enrollment for the ACA starts on November 1st, and this year ends on December 15th. That's a 45-day window that's cut in half from what it was previously. There's also far less support and advertising for open enrollment. You might call it a sabotage effort. So make sure that you, your loved ones, your friends, your people in your life know you can sign up for healthcare coverage through the ACA starting November 1st, hard deadline December 15th. For more information, you can go to healthcare.gov or getamericacovered.org. We'll have links to both of these in the program notes. And I want to remind you, too, that last month we had ACA expert Andy Slavitt, who ran the Affordable Care Act, Medicare, and Medicaid under President Barack Obama, on as our sit-down guest, episode 16. So if you haven't listened to that episode, or if you want to revisit Andy's talking points about the importance of the ACA, especially for people with bleeding disorders and other chronic conditions, you can go back and check out episode 16 of this very podcast. We have another update, too, from episode 16. We talked about in both episode 15 and 16, actually, the hemophilia community in the UK, and they're pursuing legal action in response to the blood contamination crisis in the UK. Since our last recording, there is an update that the community there has won the right to sue the government over the contaminated blood scandal. So there were some lawsuits in the 90s. There were settlements of some kind. I don't know the specifics, so I won't try to get into it. But that was a sticking point. Would some of those resolved cases from the 90s prevent legal action from taking place today? And the ruling judge declared that no. New information has been brought to light, and we cannot have any more delays. We still have a fair number of people who are affected by this directly alive, and we can't afford to delay this any further. So it moves
forward.
That's a win. Big win. Now, they still need a chair for this investigation, since Theresa May said in July, I think it was, that this is something that needed to be addressed. That's all well and good, but there isn't a chair, and the chair is to be appointed by the Department of Health in the UK. Evidently, what they call consultations are being extended through October 18th. So theoretically, in a couple days after this episode comes out, there should be more information about this lawsuit and about the chair of this inquiry. So we'll keep you posted through our social media outlets, at Bloodstream Info on Twitter, Bloodstream Media on Facebook, and we'll give you any pertinent updates when we record episode 18 in November. Lastly here, did want to mention, obviously we have been hit by many natural disasters in the last couple of months, most recently and catastrophically. Puerto Rico was buried under Hurricane Maria, right?
Correct,
Maria?
Yeah.
Harvey, Irma, Maria, can't even... They're coming too fast and furious. NHF has started a Puerto Rico Relief Fund. So if you would like to make a contribution that goes directly toward helping people with hemophilia, This is now labeled as a humanitarian crisis. And if you would like to specifically try to help Blood Brothers and Sisters in Puerto Rico, you can do that through NHF's Puerto Rico Relief Fund. Links in the program notes. Also want to give a couple shout-outs. Bioverative Shire, I know, and there's probably others, but I know about those two who've donated Factor in response to this crisis. And I just read, actually, this morning, big shout-out to Bill Patsakos. Bill's the father of four boys, three of whom have hemophilia B. He is also a pharmacist and a Fire Department of New York lieutenant. Bill made his way to Puerto Rico on October 6th to help families with hemophilia and also help with the relief efforts through the FDNY. So we want to give a big shout out to Bill for literally just getting up and going and using his skills and to help community and people in Puerto Rico. So thank you to Bill. Thank you to everybody who's done something to help the community that's going through these ridiculous times. It's kind of unimaginable to someone like, you know, me who hasn't grown up in hurricanes and or an earthquake country or in tornado country. You know, we talked a bit.
But even if you have this, the fact that there's no power for so long, you know, running water, electricity. I mean, that's power, but you know, it's
no. This is different. You're right.
This is different. Very different and horrific.
So again, links in the program notes if you'd like to help out. All right, so a little bit of housekeeping here. Natalie, what's the first item on our outline for housekeeping? What's to say right there?
Bloodstream Stories presents The Factor Revolution, The last 60 years of hemophilia treatment.
Nice. Well read, well read.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm a good reader. been doing it for 32 years.
Very impressive. The way you just, 8 letters, 9 letters, doesn't throw you off. Revolution, you plow right through that word. Yeah, The Factor Revolution's been coming out. So we've been working on this for a while. And I'm actually really curious to hear your thoughts in a moment, Natalie, because you've kind of been in the dark on this until the episode came out. So you're kind of fresh ears to what we've been doing with The Factor Revolution. But the idea behind this series was that for the longest time, and forgive me if those of you have listened to it, just to give like a little 1-minute summary, it is coming out through this RSS feed. It's part of the Bloodstream podcast. But for those who haven't yet checked out those first two episodes of the series, it basically chronicles the history of hemophilia treatment, which frankly isn't much of a story until about 1950. So it's really looking at the last, you know, 67 years where we've gone from a life expectancy of age 10-13 to life expectancy on par with our peers in the general population, a quality of life that was unimaginable to people like Randy Curtis, who is in his 60s living with hemophilia. You hear from him in the series. But you don't just hear from him. You hear from so many people. It's
yeah,
40
that's,
different.
I mean, that's what I liked about it when I listened to it. I liked that there are a lot of different voices and there's these little splices of stories. And I think it's really good if you're someone who listening to a podcast or aren't an auditory learner, it actually is for you
because it's moving along.
It moves. And the voices, the way the stories are told too, I'm, you know, picturing, you know, Randy in elementary school and it's just really well painted and, you know, I assume if you're listening to this podcast, you are someone who enjoys listening to things, but I would share The Factor Revolution with people who this is not your cup of tea because I think this could be their cup of tea.
I think that's a great point. And one of the things we struggle with in our community, even with content creation that we do here at Bloodstream and at Believe All the Time, is how do we get people outside of our community to care? You know, how do we raise a little bit more awareness? How do we cultivate another champion or advocate for our community? I think The Factor Revolution, as you're saying, because of the way it's produced, is something that you could hear it on NPR.
Yeah.
And you would be very happy if you had This American Life on and you heard The Factor Revolution. So don't just listen to it for yourself. I think Natalie's point is a great one. It's a wonderful piece that you could share.
To share with someone in your life outside the community who's like, I don't really understand hemophilia. And to just say, like, listen to this 3-part series and you will.
Yeah, and you will appreciate that in the last 70 years we have made an enormous, kind of incomprehensible amount of progress on something that prior to we had since 2000 or whenever BC, from then until 1950, it was like nothing.
Yeah,
and now where we are. So, all right, that's our pitch for listening to The Factor Revolution. Check it out, episode 1, Factor Revolution Begins, episode 2, The Blood Contamination Crisis. Both have come out. They're on this RSS feed. And then as of Monday, October 23rd, 1 week from the release of this episode, episode 3 of The Factor Revolution, Stability, Vigilance, and New Frontiers will go live.
Check it out.
We've also got a new episode of the Powering Through podcast, episode 9, which features quite a heavy-hitting lineup. We have NHF CEO Val Bias, HFA CEO and President Kimberly Hogstad, COT President Carl Wexler, and the National AIDS Memorial Grove Executive Director John Cunningham for a conversation built around the blood contamination crisis, the devastating impact it had on our community, the wounds that it left behind, and how we continue the process of healing. We've spoken a decent amount on this podcast about the National AIDS Memorial Grove and the Hemophilia Memorial and last year's World AIDS Day, so I won't rehash all of that now. But if you would like to hear these four well-informed community titans speak about this most sensitive topic, highly recommend you check out Powering Through Podcast Episode 9 at poweringthrough.org. Ask the Expert Episode 7 features longtime community activist, advocate, and recently mentioned just now by me and Natalie Guy, Randy Curtis, who addresses questions concerning the baby boomer generation and the Gen X members of our community. What is top of mind for those folks in our community 2017 moving into 2018 and beyond? Stop the Bleeding Bloopers from Season 7 are now available at stbhemo.com or on facebook.com/stbhemo or on YouTube, where you can check out the Blood Feed YouTube channel. If you need just 3 minutes of laughing at silly people doing silly things that never quite made it to the screen, check out the bloopers from Stop the Bleeding, stbhemo.com. And as always, keep up with Bloodstream Media on social, facebook.com/bloodstreammedia, at bloodstreaminfo on Twitter. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast on iTunes, Downcast, Stitcher, wherever you listen to podcasts, your podcast app on your phone. Hit that subscribe button. Finally, don't forget, you can send us feedback, ideas, or you could submit your short essay for consideration as a future share segment piece by emailing mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. And I do have to admit, we recently discovered that we haven't had that email address properly set up.
Oops.
So we found some emails that needed responses and needed responses quite a while ago. So apologies for that. However, the good news here is that now we are very aware of that email address. So you can send us emails. We're going to see them so quickly. We're going to see those ideas so quickly. We're going to respond to you so quickly.
I know
what I'm doing. It's not a good idea. We're going to be so on top of it, everybody. So just send so many emails to us. Send us all kinds of emails. Send us, test us. Test us out. How strong we are at checking mailbag at bloodstreammedia.com. But yeah, mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com.
All right, today's like segment, the top five things new moms and or moms of newly diagnosed children need.
Where are these from? Where are these top five things from, Natalie?
They are from me. So as a doula, part of my job is bringing things to my clients, to my moms, and helping them transition into this new phase. And I was thinking about it the other day, the things that new moms need, whether it's just an infant without a bleeding disorder, are very similar to those if you are finding out with your child at 3 years old, they now have a bleeding disorder. You're kind of going back to that new mom phase because you are a new mom in a different way. So the things that you needed when you were transitioning from maidenhood to motherhood, you need as you're transitioning from a mom to a mom with a child with a bleeding disorder.
That makes sense.
So the number one thing, and I mean, they're not actually in order, just...
Oh, but a quick question first, though. Was anything left off the list? Like, were there any, like, close contenders, but it was like, eh, you're sixth, seventh place. I can't make... Any, like, near misses?
I mean, yeah, there's a lot of things new moms need. And this goes for dads, too. You know, I specialize in moms, but... I don't want to leave the dads out.
That's very thoughtful, very inclusive of you. Thank you. All right, so take us through, no particular order, like you said, what are the top five things new moms need?
So I think new moms need community. And what community is a group of people who are sharing this experience. So whether you're sharing the experience of having a newborn and what that's like, or being a newly diagnosed mother. So what I think is important about community is... It's important to find community of people who are going through it while you're going through it. Because just like when you have a newborn and your mother or your mother-in-law says, oh, well, you know, when you were that age,
right,
there is this space between when they were going through it. And there's also things that have happened.
Yeah, the world's different.
The world's different. So it's important to be, to have someone that you can lean on who it's like, oh yeah, that just happened with me too. And this right. is how I dealt with it.
Right.
So it's finding that community. It's finding that tribe that supports you. Hmm. Number two is a consistent self-care practice. So as a new mom,
Shoemaker's son sort of theory at play here.
You know, you need to be, you are taking care of your child. And who's taking care of you?
Right.
You need to also be taking care of you. And I know a lot of the moms that I talk to, like, what? But I don't have time. So you can make time. And if you have time to be on social media, if you have time to be checking your Facebook, you have time to be taking care of yourself. And maybe that's part of taking care of you is connecting socially.
Sure.
But, you know, we can kind of get lost in a time suck in those worlds. And it's important to make sure that your health, you know, when you're making appointments for your child, that you're making appointments for yourself as well, that you're taking care of your health.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. Just a quick interjection. I was having a conversation with a nurse practitioner at one of the HTCs in Massachusetts yesterday, and she was talking about how often she's pushing carriers or women with mild hemophilia to make their own appointments when they're there with their son.
Yeah.
And she's saying, you know, well, we also need to run some stuff on you and make sure that you're doing okay and that your health is up. And often it's like, oh, can we just do that now? It's like, no, I don't. Your kid's in the room. Like, are we going to talk about, you know, your periods right now? Like, it needs its own attention. But she was also identifying that for a lot of parents, it's like, oh, another doctor appointment. And this one's for me. That's the thing that gets scrapped.
Yeah. And it's so important. And there's the things like doctor's appointments, but then there's the things like just taking a bath or, you know, going on a jog. And maybe that means scheduling it out, you
right.
know, like where it's like Tuesdays at 9 a.m., 9 to 10 a.m. when my kid's napping or they're at daycare, or like that time is my time and it's sacred. Like, and that almost as though you have a business meeting during that time so that other things don't happen during that time and that
right.
it's dedicated self-care time. So I think that's important. And it's self-care is not selfish. Mm. Like, you will be a better mom if you are taking time for yourself. So that's number
awesome.
Two.
All right. What's number three?
Number three is resources. I think what's important is finding, and you can find this within your community, there's someone who's come before you who has aggregated a list of things. And this might not be a perfect list for you, but I think it's a great place to start. So it's going through and being like, okay, this list has, you know, a tried and true HTC or hematologist. This list has, you know, just like a place where you can take your kid to do activities that other moms have taken their kids, and it feels right, it feels safe. And you might go do it and you say, that's not for me. And I think so the cool part about the resource list is find one and then create your own from that. You know, this worked for me, this didn't. This is something I found that I can add to my resource list. So then you can be a resource for someone else at some point.
Right, right, exactly. Okay.
Number four is help. And what I mean by help is both service and financial. I think it's very hard for women in particular to accept help. And I think that it's important. And this is different from community because help can be outside your community. It can be your family members. It can be your friends. It's someone who comes and says, you know, I'd like to take your kid for the afternoon or make a donation to this or say yes, accept it. Because when someone comes and brings services, that maybe you can use that time for your self-care. You know, it's always accept help when it's given to you.
I think we also forget that when we are help givers, it feels good to give help. So we can be modest or humble or what have you and say, oh, no, thank you. I don't need that. But it's also, it's useful to remember like, well, actually, it feels good to allow someone else to help. People like being helpful.
Yeah.
So saying yes is number one, meeting the need that you have, that the individual is trying to help, but also you're allowing them an opportunity to be useful, not just to feel useful, but to be useful.
Yeah.
All right. And what's bringing us home? What's number five?
And number five is a little abstract, but it's patience. You need
like,
patience.
Like a lot of patience, like hospital patients, like people.
No, the virtue.
Ah.
And, you know, that's an easy thing to say, yeah, you know, after sleepless nights or, you know, a 3-year-old with a bleed that you, you know, like have, you're just exhausted and
sure.
emotionally drained, to say, yeah, of course I need patience. But one tactic that I use to cultivate more patience is to highlight the times when I don't have patience. Because those are easy to say, like, oh, I snapped last night at my husband.
Mm.
And so it's highlighting and isolating those instances where it's like, I didn't have patience there. How could I have had more patience? So every time you hit an episode where you are not exuding patience, to name it and to kind of rewrite that history in your mind of how you could have done that if you would have had patience. And I feel like doing that exercise allows you to have more awareness coming up in the moments and step back and have patience. So I think it's a really good practice and a good way to cultivate, you know, this abstract, like, yeah, new moms are like, yeah, of course I need patience, but yeah.
No, but that's a good way of, you know, thinking about it in retrospect and labeling it as such, identifying maybe another course of action that you could have taken, not for the purposes of like flogging yourself, but just for the purposes of knowing what options are available. That will inform you as you go forward.
And if you name those options that are available, they're going to be more readily accessible in a moment where your patience is tried.
Because you're literally teaching your brain. Like, it's not just like a quaint idea, right? It's neuro pathways, and there's actual like scientific
evidence. Neuroplasticity.
There you go. Yeah. Actual scientific evidence to support this. All right, so run down that list one more time for everybody.
So number one, community. Number two, a consistent self-care practice. Number three, resources. Number four, help. Both service and financial. And number five, patience.
Excellent. Thank you, Natalie.
Yeah.
And we are going to have, I guess we'll call it a blog version of this list. So it'll be the list along with a few lines of kind of how you are framing each of these five things, and some links to valuable websites, resources, etc. on the blog page at bloodstreampod.com.
Check it out.
Now for our episode 17 share segment, we turn the audio over to two voices you've probably heard a few times already this month, Ryan Geelan and Seth Kirshner, the multi-talented producers behind Bloodstream Media's new Factor Revolution series. Only this time they're going to give you some insight into who they are and the work they've been doing for Bloodstream Media and Believe Limited. Take it away, gentlemen.
I'm Ryan Geelan. I co-founded Believe Limited with the host of this podcast, Patrick James Lynch. This was about 6 years ago when we started the company. So it was about 6.5 years ago when I first learned what hemophilia was. I literally didn't know bleeding disorders existed before meeting and becoming friends with Patrick. How about you, Seth?
Yeah, pretty much the same story. I mean, I knew what hemophilia was, but I didn't know anyone with hemophilia before Patrick.
Yeah, you were doing improv, acting, writing.
Yeah.
Could you ever see yourself spending the vast majority of your time?
I would say that if you would have told me about 5 or 6 years ago that the majority of the content that I create is going to be surrounding the hemophilia community or the bleeding disorders community, I would have said, prove it.
And same with me as a filmmaker, nothing to do with bleeding disorders.
Yeah, and now we're fully engulfed.
Yeah. I like to joke that we're adopted members of the community, and I say that as an honor. It's fantastic. Over the last 6 years, we've attended national and regional events to family education days and walks all over the country. The level of unity and support that filters out from the national organizations to the state chapters and other organizations is incredible.
Yeah, from the top down to individual families supporting each other, the bonds in this community, honestly, they seem extraordinary. And they have to be. I mean, the potential costs of living with a bleeding disorder in the family.
Or in some cases, multiple bleeding disorders in the family or multiple children with the same bleeding disorder.
Right. The costs in terms of money and time and emotional energy can be enormous, truly enormous. So the bonds we see and the information sharing and the programming aimed at spreading information and education.
It all seems very powerful and very necessary.
Yes.
I think that's why we wanted to do the share segment this month. We wanted to introduce ourselves, to say thank you for welcoming us into the community, for sharing this world with us, and we wanted to ask a favor.
Oh, okay. All right, we're like that friend who shows up at your birthday party and asks to borrow money.
No, not that kind of favor.
Are we going to ask to borrow their car?
No, how would that even work?
Oh, okay, so we're going to ask them to help us move, or Oh, I'll ride to the airport. We're going to ask for a ride to the airport.
No, Seth, man, you have been burned by friends before.
Many times.
It is clear. Yeah. We can talk about that off the air. I'm saying the favor I'm thinking of is about these incredible connections in the community.
Ah, okay, I see.
So for most of the work we do, the videos, the podcasts, the films, the live events, we get to speak with community members of every age and every demographic all over the country.
Even community members around the world now. We hear the community stories and we help tell them in video form, in podcast form, in the form of performance art and music.
And these are stories about every aspect of life with a bleeding disorder.
Because a bleeding disorder does touch every part of life. We hear incredible stories about being a kid with a bleeding disorder today versus 30 years ago, or surviving the contamination crisis, addiction and dependency with pain medication, being a parent of someone with a bleeding disorder, or dating someone with a bleeding disorder. We hear about healthcare horror stories and healthcare heroes. We hear about disclosure challenges at work or in dating.
We hear about financial challenges and support programs and births and deaths, about a support phone call or community event that changed the course of a life or the course of a family's life.
And we try to turn those stories into digestible, shareable content for the good of the community. As an actor and writer, I have always believed in the power of story to reach people, to touch hearts and minds.
Totally. And with the clutter of information today, it takes something special to cut through, and we aim for special. But the stories, the incredible journeys in this community, do most of the work for us.
And that's really the point of the share segment, I think.
Yeah, that's the favor I was going to ask for. We want to encourage people who hear this to share their stories.
Yeah, and to whatever extent you're comfortable, obviously.
Of course. And just know there are tons of us on the outside who want to know. Some of us are adopted members of the community, like me and Seth.
Some are industry who want to be inspired or enlightened by your journey.
Some are legislators who are constantly facing a tough fight on healthcare, who may not have a clue how their decision could affect your family.
And some, we've learned, are new community members who may feel lost and overwhelmed by a new diagnosis.
So I guess in a way, this share segment is about sharing.
Nice, full circle.
Yeah, so tell your story, share your wisdom, make an impact. And there's actually one thing specifically we'd like to ask about today.
Yeah, we're doing a lot of work around the new ACA enrollment windows opening November 1st, basically nationwide. If you have a story about how the Affordable Care Act or ACA or Obamacare helped you and your family, we'd love to hear it.
Yes. Let the sharing begin! Just shoot a quick email to mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. That's M-A-I-L-B-A-G, mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. And tell us your story and the best way to get in touch with you.
I love it.
Yeah. Hey, Seth.
Yep.
Can I borrow your car?
I knew it.
Please?
No.
Fine, but I do need that ride to the airport.
Hi, my name is Seth. I'd like to share my story about having an annoying friend named Ryan.
Oh, come on. That's all the time we have. Back to you, Patrick and Natalie.
Thank you, Ryan and Seth, for contributing that awesome share segment piece. If you haven't already listened to episodes 1 and 2 of Factor Revolution, first of all, what are you doing? Or if you'd like to know the fastest way to send your family and friends to the series, simply visit bloodstreampod.com/factor. Again, that's bloodstreampod.com/factor. And of course, all episodes of the Bloodstream podcast, including our Factor Revolution story series, can be downloaded from iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, don't forget to subscribe to have our latest episodes delivered directly to you. Episode 3 of Factor Revolution goes live on Monday, October 23rd. Okay, so Natalie, for the comment segment on episode 17 of the Bloodstream podcast, we talking about weed.
Marijuana.
That's right, we are. So a couple different things we want to bring up here, but what really jump-started this piece was an opinion piece that I found in The Hill on October 2nd, and it was written in response to a recently completed meeting titled Innovative Pain Management and Prevention Measures for Diversion. This is part of the President's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis. The author of this piece, Steph Scherer, I should mention, is the founder and executive director of Americans for Safe Access, which is the largest national member-based organization for patients, scientists, concerned citizens, and others who are promoting safe and legal access to cannabis for therapeutic use and research. That's her MO. In fact, she and the ASA, Americans for Safe Access, did appeal to be invited to this meeting, but were denied. Who was there? Well, 10 organizations were invited to provide testimony and participate in discussion. All 10 were from the pharmaceutical industry, and the author points out there are numerous non-pharmaceutical interdisciplinary approaches and therapies to pain management that weren't discussed at all. And a glaring omission was medical cannabis. She goes on to cite a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association that states with a medical cannabis program have a 25% reduction in opioid-related deaths. The study also showed a 13% decrease in hospitalizations from opioid-related causes. And this number I found particularly like, hello, in a survey of nearly 3,000 pain patients, I like that term, I'm a pain patient, 93% preferred medical cannabis over opioid therapies, excuse me. And it's worth stating that states with these medical cannabis programs that have this 25% reduction in deaths and these other, you know, encouraging statistics, these are states like West Virginia, New Hampshire, Ohio. They've been devastated by the opioid crisis. And we see that with a medical cannabis program, we're reducing one out of every four deaths, or we're removing one out of every four deaths. The author does acknowledge cannabis alone isn't going to solve the opioid crisis. It's not going to resolve everybody's pain. But if we're going to be having these panels about, quote, innovative ways of tackling pain management, and we're not even going to discuss non-pharmaceutical options, and we're not even going to discuss cannabis, then what are we really doing?
Well, it sort of takes innovative out of the picture.
Yeah, you could. It just goes to show you can title something whatever you want, but the merits of what it is will determine what it truly is. So this comes out around the same time that an article in Rolling Stone was published that acknowledged that Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican senator and an octogenarian from the great state of Utah, is among a frustrated set of national policymakers who were quite upset following a Washington Post story about Attorney General Jeff Sessions. So Jeff Sessions, our Attorney General, his Justice Department is blocking the Drug Enforcement Agency, or DEA, from approving about two dozen proposals for experts to research the effects of marijuana. And I'm going to read directly from Rolling Stone now. Not to legalize weed, not to sell it, not even to smoke it, but merely to study it, just as is allowed with deadly and highly addictive opioids, booze, and even cigarettes, to find out if 38 states and the District of Columbia have made grave mistakes by allowing marijuana to be used either medically or recreationally, or whether those states are actually onto something. Additionally, there may be private investors and activists who would be interested in studying medical cannabis for medical therapeutic uses, but pot remains listed by the DEA as a Schedule I drug, which is a classification that by its very definition means the government sees no medical benefit to it whatsoever, which is just insane in 2017. So, in response to all this, Senator Orrin Hatch and a group of colleagues have introduced a bill intended to help promote the study of medical marijuana. And I have to point out that on the statement on his website, one of the first sentences from Senator Hatch was, "It's high time to address research into medical marijuana." I don't know Orrin Hatch's creativity level or sense of humor in general. I can't imagine that he meant that as a pun, but I also can't imagine that a staffer wasn't like, "Oh, hey, Senator Hatch, just want to let you know, you wrote high time right in the beginning of the weed statement. It's a funny pun. I just want to make sure you know that, but you should totally leave it in." They know what they're doing, right? Anyway, one other thing I want to point out before Natalie and I kind of capsule this. The bill that was proposed, it is called the Marijuana Effective Drug Study Act of 2017, or MEDS Act is the acronym. And the idea is that it is to improve the process for conducting scientific research on marijuana as a safe and effective medical treatment. In introducing legislation, Senator Hatch was joined by Senator Schatz, a Democrat from Hawaii, co-sponsors Senator Chris Coons, Democrat from Delaware, Senator Cory Gardner, Republican from Colorado, and Senator Tom Tillis, Republican from North Carolina. And the reason I want to go through those names is you see, in addition to Republican Senator from Utah, Orrin Hatch, Democrat from Hawaii, Democrat from Delaware, Republican from Colorado, which is a purpler and purpler state, and Republican from North Carolina. So we see here, we talk about all the division in the country right now. All the numbers seem to indicate that we ought to have a piece of legislation like this. Now, I don't know the bill's ins and outs, and there might be people who I ideologically agree with that could, you know, pick apart why this bill is not the right move forward. I'm going to put that aside. The very idea that we have a bipartisan effort that includes people like Orrin Hatch from Utah, a Mormon conservative state, and people like Cory Gardner and Hawaii, and like we have a nice diverse mix of lawmakers who are behind wanting to standardize how we study this thing to see what medical potential it could have for us. And even saying medical potential to me feels crazy, because we know that there's potential. It's a question of just how much. But until we have federal protections around studying this stuff, it's going to live in the shadows. And until, frankly, Attorney General Jeff Sessions is really forced to reconcile his position on marijuana, and we don't have enough time to get into that, we're going to be at a tricky point. So I'm proud to see that Senator Hatch and these four others are stepping up and saying, okay, let's introduce legislation. Let's really move this conversation along, especially in light of what seemed to be box-checking meetings about innovative pain management techniques that clearly aren't doing anything terribly progressive or envelope-pushing with studying how we dig into pain management and the opioid crisis. End of rant. Natalie, your thoughts?
I mean, my mind's just blown. Like, it makes so much sense. Like, why can't we study something that there's so much anecdotal, and not even anecdotal, if you look at the reductions in states where this is legal, these aren't antidotes. This isn't my friend's sister's cousin's goldfish kind of story. This is actually reducing deaths in a crisis. So why aren't we hip to researching it?
Well,
it's insane.
All right, well, so let's stay on that. To answer your question, why aren't we hip to researching it, I think we have to go back and look at why marijuana is... So we're not researching it because it is a DEA class one drug, no medical benefit whatsoever on a federal level, and we have a attorney general who's head of the Justice Department barring us from having, what, 24 proposals for research go through, because he has a career, you can check his record, of criminalizing and using the criminalization of marijuana against key demographics that are of political interest to him. And he's not the first to do that. That is why marijuana was originally labeled as a class one drug. It was a way to criminalize people during the Nixon era in protesting of the Vietnam War, or people who were marching in support of civil rights. You can't arrest people for taking a knee at a football game during the anthem. You can't arrest people for marching down the street with a sign that says, get out of Vietnam. But you can arrest people if they're in possession of a class one drug and you can incarcerate them for a long period of time. That is literally why marijuana is still a DEA class one drug that is not allowed to be researched at a federal level. Still, it has nothing to do with what we have scientifically actually learned about cannabis, the things that you're citing. We have, it's not just anecdotes about goldfish. It's actual statistics and numbers. It's things that policymakers should love, because it takes it from the abstract and makes it real concrete when you can just look at it on paper. Hey, look, medical cannabis programs, 25% reduction in opioid deaths. Why aren't we supporting this? Answer, we have weaponized this product, marijuana and cannabis, to be used as a political tool at the convenience of those in power. And you can't have a sober conversation about cannabis and research and bringing medical marijuana to market without acknowledging that truth and combating that simultaneously. And that is rooted in all kinds of political, cultural, racial, criminal justice system stuff. Like, that's a whole huge
can of worms
topic in and of itself. But it's a part of the story. There's no way to split the difference.
And I think there's fear in researching this because the research is going to clearly state,
of course,
some things we already know.
Of course.
And that's going to be real damaging to some people's wallets.
To their wallets, to their reputations, because they have just decided they're I shouldn't even say reputations because some of these calloused people, but you're right. To the bottom line is to people's wallets and to people's positions of power. Power and money. Corrupt.
Well, and then people who...
Power and money corrupt. I'm going to get real philosophical at the end of this little bit here, Natalie.
No, but people who... There are people who will not try marijuana because it's illegal. There's a group of people 100%. Who this could
benefit. That's their number one barrier. Number one barrier. It's illegal. The same way it used to be illegal to use certain restrooms if you were of a certain skin color. Legality is a human thing. We determine that. It's not a right and wrong thing.
So, you know, there's a group of people who won't even try it, whose lives could be forever changed because this does not have the side effects these other things have or the addictive properties.
Do you know, in the research for this, and we got to move on in a second here, but in the research for this, I read a story about this veteran who has gone through 7 knee surgeries, 5 shoulder surgeries. There was a list of things that this guy's gone through, and of course he's dealing with PTSD. At one point, he was at an inpatient psychiatric unit because nothing was working for this guy. He did not want to try marijuana. That wasn't like on his radar. He did, and he says, it changed my life. I got choked up reading this. He's like, it changed my life for the first time since I've come home. I got 5 hours of sleep in a row. I tried it again the next day. Same thing. It has changed my life. Why aren't we? We're in the middle of the longest war we've ever fought. We're piling up veterans to serve. And the VA, if you reach out to the VA, it's because you're a veteran in need. You're not bored. You have needs. And the VA isn't allowed to promote and help push forward the use of cannabis for therapeutic purposes because of our stupid backward system. And guys like him are not getting the help they need because of stupid backward, politically motivated criminalizing of this potential miracle for many, 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 many people like that guy.
Yeah.
All right, we got to take a deep breath and move on because it's too much. But anyway, this is obviously a topic that I care about, Natalie cares about. We'll continue to kind of see how things move. And particularly, we'll keep you posted on anything related to this Meds Act bill that Senator Hatch and company have now introduced. We'll see where it goes. Hey, Natalie.
Hey, what?
Where does Little Red Riding Hood's grandmother live?
In the woods. On the other side of the woods.
It's not like the Shire, or is that Bilbo Baggins or someone? Isn't there like a fantasy character that lives in the Shire?
Not Little Red Riding Hood.
Okay. Well, you know what the good news is? The Bloodstream Podcast is brought to us exclusively by Shire. And for that, we say,
Thank you, Shire.
I don't know. Dan Levy is the sit-down guest here on episode 17 of the Bloodstream podcast. Dan is a Philadelphia-based sports writer, formerly had his own radio show and podcast, but he's best known within the bleeding disorders community for being the father of Iron Max. You may recall from just paying attention to the community, or perhaps specifically here on the podcast, we've talked about Iron Max before. Max was featured in some NBC News segments for having hemophilia and the way that his family and sister in particular responded by creating awareness and fundraising tools in response to Max's diagnosis. We wanted to have Dan on to talk about what he's learned from his experience in the community in the last couple few years, the role of media and the role of sports in the lives of, well, any of us, really. I'm just excited to talk to a guy about sports on this podcast, I'll be honest. But here we go, Dan Levy. All right, so thanks, Dan. Thanks for making the time to come on. I appreciate that.
Thank you for having me.
And as I don't often get the opportunity to talk to anyone about sports on the Bloodstream podcast, let's just open with the fact that you are a sports writer. When did the sports world become something that you knew you wanted to pursue professionally?
It just sort of pursued me, I think. When I was in college, I was sitting at home, and a friend of one of my parents said, you know, I know somebody, I went to Rutgers in New Jersey, and she said, I know somebody in the sports information office. You know, you always liked sports and played sports and you like to write and do things like that. So why don't you go over and talk to her? And when I went back to school, I did and never left. I actually was a student there and then ended up working there professionally for 10 years in sports information. I did all the graphic design actually for the athletic department, designed the Rutgers logo and things like that. And then actually probably toward the tail end of my time there, before we had our first child, Zoe, I started a podcast with a friend of mine, and we just talked about sports. And I had obviously had a good relationship with a bunch of journalists, because covering sports information, you work on the other side of journalism, helping them, I guess helping them. And so it sort of spawned into a media career that has lasted roughly 10 years. I had a radio show, worked for Bleacher Report, Sporting News, a couple of other notable places, and now I work for Sight in Philly and Pittsburgh, handling all the sports for them. So it's been a fun sort of ride. It's one of those cool things to talk about at parties when people say, oh, what do you do for a living? Oh, I write about sports for a living. And then they want to talk to you about it. So that's never fun, because everyone has opinions. But it's a different kind of challenge.
Sure. Well, all right. So as a guy who grew up a Knicks fan, but is, unfortunately a Knicks fan, I'm kind of always on the market year to year for a new team to follow, be excited about, be interested in. The Philadelphia 76ers should be front of mind for a lot of NBA fans. So give us the 30-second pitch. Why should we care about the Philadelphia 76ers in the 2017-18 basketball season?
Well, if you get in now, it's sort of like buying a stock when it's cheap and you think it's going to explode. This team has been terrible for a few years, and purposefully, the tanking process, and then it became the process, which capital T, capital P on that. People who have trusted that process are getting rewarded finally. They have a ton of young talent, and they're likable people. They're likable players. They've brought in some veterans this year. I don't think they're winning the championship in the next 2 or 3 years, but I definitely think it's going to be one of the most fun teams to watch on the court. So if you're just a casual sports fan and you see the Sixers, they're going to be on national TV, I think, between 15, 20 times or something this year, a lot. If you have a chance to watch them, they're just a heck of a lot of fun to watch.
All right, so moving into what connects us, and that is hemophilia, for better or for worse. You mentioned just a few minutes ago when you and your wife had your first child, Zoe. When did you know that hemophilia was going to be a part of your lives? Was it not until after Max was born? Was there a family history? When did you first find out about hemophilia in the family?
No, there was no family history at all. It turns out that we know now that Zoe is a carrier, but we didn't even find that out until, I think, last year, and she's 10. Max was born, he's about 7 and a half, and so we found out at 9 months from Max. He had some issues when he was circumcised in the hospital, and he bled quite a bit, and no one thought about it. No one even mentioned anything about he could have an issue. The nurse, who frankly was not great, my wife's nurse, when Max was born, was like, oh, the doctor must have nicked him. And they cauterized it, and they tried some tape, and they did all these things. And it's your firstborn son, and you're like, I don't think this is how this works. Like, I don't think he's supposed to be bleeding from there for as long as he is. And no one said anything. Oh, it'll be fine. And thankfully, it stopped after about 2 days of dealing with that. Not an immense amount of blood for 2 days, but certainly some troubled times for a couple of days. He needed a revision. At 6 months, we scheduled that for 9 months. And then at 9 months, the same thing happened, where he was consistently bleeding. And it's everybody in this community has their story. And our story is there was a blizzard outside of Philly that day. And we opened up Max's diaper and it was full of blood. And we said, we have to go to the hospital. And we couldn't get out. There was so much snow. And it's one of those superhuman strength things. You always feel like you could lift a car if you need to. I shoveled a foot of snow as quickly as humanly possible, as we called an ambulance, and the ambulance was able to come to the house. Of course, they didn't even pull in the driveway. And so they're on the street, and I'm like, I shoveled for nothing. And they took Max to the hospital. They looked at him and said, we're not touching this boy. We're going to send him to CHOP. And my wife and Max went over to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and that's where they did the first tests. And that's when we found out. We didn't even really know what hemophilia was. We knew it was blood-related. But until about 7 years ago, we had no idea.
And was he diagnosed prior to getting to CHOP, or was it at CHOP that they actually gave him the diagnosis?
It was at CHOP. There was a doctor in the ER in New Jersey that I don't remember if that doctor floated this or we maybe had looked it up, but we actually thought that he could have had von Willebrand's, because when the doctor talked to us about is there any bleeding history in the family, my brother had severe nosebleeds growing up. And there was no diagnosis of a bleeding disorder, but he had terrible nosebleeds. And I actually do a little bit too. So we thought, well, maybe it's von Willebrand's, maybe it's in my family. We never even suspected and never thought anything that it would be Marissa's family or her, and it turns out that it came from her. The rest of her family got tested this past year. Her mother and her sister got tested, and they don't have, they're not carriers, and they don't have the gene that she has. So she is a carrier, and she is, I always get the percent wrong, I think 40%, so she actually is mild, which she never knew her entire life until Max. And we've gone to, you know, these conferences and learned quite a bit about that. She's learned a lot in the last 2 years about herself that she never would have thought of were it not for Max and the situation that he's gone through. So it's been, even still, you know, we said it was a crash course when we found out about Max, but we're still learning about this.
Yeah, sure. And of course, I want to ask you specifically about Max, but that's intriguing. So let's just stay on that for a second. You said your wife learned a lot about her own health recently. Are there a couple few things that you've that either she's learned for herself or just your involvement in the community have made you aware? Actually, a lot of mild hemophiliacs, women with mild hemophilia carriers, have this experience. Are there top of mind things that come to mind?
Yeah, I mean, she has had, you know, heavy bleeding her whole life, and had some surgeries early on that she looks back on and thinks like, wow, I wish I would have known. I probably needed Factor for some of those situations. And even just her looking back on how she's handled things, how just different circumstances in her life, sort of in a different scope now. Like, wow, this is something that you're not going to test everyone for. Like, she wasn't like Max, we're bruising all the time and bleeding all the time. But when you do have a child, like, it's important to take care of yourself. And I think she's doing a much better job now. She's got her own hematologist. She, you know, checks in regularly, things like that, which she never had done previous.
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, on this same episode, Natalie covers a piece that's designed for moms, new moms particularly. And what are the five things that you need? And one of them being self-care, and how it's understandable, especially when you have a child that has a chronic condition, that you want to all the more so throw your parental caregiver self behind your child. But if you're not also taking care of yourself, you know, the put on your own oxygen mask before helping others, right?
Yeah, and you know, it's one of those things where I sort of think that it adds a little bit of a connection between the two of them. I feel it sounds so weird to say this, but I feel kind of left out in some of those situations. And when we found out that Zoe was a carrier, she sort of fist pumped, and she was actually a little bit even disappointed when she found out about her number. I think she's pretty high percentage. And she really wanted to be a part of it. She wanted to share this with Max, and you know, they're as close as any boy and girl can be, you know, brother and sister can be. But I think they sort of got even closer when she realized, like, she gets to share this with him forever. And if she obviously has kids, then you know, they can sort of handle this together, and we'll have a lot more. She's 10. We have plenty of time, but we'll have a lot more knowledge, and hopefully by then a lot more magic and science behind this by then. But it's really sort of I'm a little jealous of them. I certainly am not jealous of Max, and I know you know that pretty well. But you know, I feel like I can be a part of this as best as possible by supporting them and helping them and being an active member in the community in the way that I can. I told Max when he is a port, but when he starts to learn how to infuse himself, that I'm going to let him test the needle on me, because I feel like then at least I can be a part of it. He can just, I'll give him my hand, and he can just get a butterfly needle and just poke me until he's tired.
You just mentioned that Max has a port, and I was wondering if you could tell us the story of how this name of Iron Max, the name that has put him on the map in a pretty big way, first came to be.
Yeah, everyone asks me, whenever I tell them, the first thing I say is, dumb luck. the good thing is about the internet is sometimes things go viral, and when it's for a positive cause, it's good. As you know, as we both know very well, sometimes things on the internet, not great. This is actually a good story. When Max was about to have his port, and it's been 3 years, a little past, we just sort of wanted to keep everyone in the loop. And you know how things are when people are having their own stressful situation. I don't want everyone texting me. Certainly didn't want my wife being bothered with it. You know, she was very emotional about this. And Max was at preschool one day, and he must have slept wrong on his nap, and his ankle was like twisted in the corner of his cot, because when he got picked up, he said his ankle hurt a little bit, and it wasn't a that big a deal. He didn't really. He was a little kid, and he was three. So he said my ankle hurts. Or by the time he got home, he had to be carried into the house, and so he couldn't walk for days. And we gave him a number of treatments. He was not on prophylaxis at that time. We gave him a number of treatments. Worked for a day or two, then it didn't. Worked for a day or two, then it didn't. And finally, he needed about a few weeks worth of treatments regularly, 3 days a week. And then it continued to still be an issue. There was still some swelling. He could walk on it, but there was still some swelling. And so we finally went to the doctor, and he was getting stuck so many times, and he was such a little kid, and he was small for his age even, that I say his veins dried up. My wife says, don't tell people that. They don't know what that means. They couldn't find a vein. And they would try this hand and try that hand and try. He would get stuck sometimes four or five times before the visiting nurse could even find a vein. And one time the nurse said, I can't give him treatment. I can't find a vein. And we said, you have to. He needs it. And she said, the only option is I could go into his foot. And she's like, I don't really want to do that, but you're right. He needs treatment. He was still swollen. And I was holding him, and she tried to put a needle into his foot. And it was, as a parent, the worst experience that I've ever been a part of. And it wasn't even me. I mean, the reaction of a three-year-old boy getting stuck in the foot is just heartbreaking. And you do your best as a parent. You don't want to make it worse for him. And that was the time where we went and talked to the doctor and said, we got to try something different here. And we decided to give him, to put a port in. And so the day of the, going back to where I started this, the day of the surgery, I didn't want to have everybody calling and texting, and is he all right, is he all right? So I said, look, just follow me on Twitter, follow me on Facebook, whatever. We'll just update it. And when we were driving Max to school the day, 2 days before, we were going to tell the school he was going to be out for a couple of days. We had just watched Iron Man the day before, the movie. And I said to him, you know that scene in Iron Man when Tony Stark takes the arc reactor out of his chest and puts it on the table and has to get the other one? And Max is like, yeah, that was so gross. I'm like, well, you're going to get one of those. You're going to have a metal disc in your chest. And he says, I'm going to be Iron Man. And I was like, I can't believe this worked. Like, this little boy is not scared at all. He's going to be Iron Man. And he walks into school and he tells his teacher, I'm going to be Iron Man. And it was the middle of the summer. And she's like, for Halloween? Like, that's early. Why are you buying your Halloween costume already? And I explained it to her, and she's like, oh, wow, he is really going to be Iron Man. And so we used Iron Max as the hashtag on Twitter, so not just the people who, our family could keep track, but, people I'm friends with on Twitter, and I have a decent following from work and whatnot. And so there were a lot of people who got behind it, and a friend of mine who is a sports writer also reviewed comic books, sent it to a few people who had written Iron Man at Marvel, and they all started wishing Max good luck. And, sharing that. And it got sort of all over, as viral as a little boy having surgery can get. And one of the writers at Marvel, Brian Bendis, sent me a note and said, I'm going to do better than wish Max good luck. I'm going to have him meet Iron Man in the comic. Took about a year, 18 months, I think, even, for that to happen, from the day that Max got his port to the time he actually appeared in Iron Man. But Max Levy is in an issue of Invincible Iron Man. It's issue 4, if people want to try and find a copy of it. And he gets to put on the Iron Man suit. And since then, the world just, everything changed for us after that.
So just because there's very few opportunities to get a look behind the curtain at the inner workings of Marvel, I would love if you would share with us a little bit of what you learned in that 18-month process.
So, he said he was going to do it and put Max in the comic. And I was like, I don't really know what this means, but I appreciate it. He's like, I wouldn't joke about this. It's going to happen. And so we stayed in touch over the next couple of months. And so what was happening, for people who don't know, Brian Michael Bendis, he's one of the top writers at Marvel and has written a bunch of big titles, Avengers and things like that. And so when the movies were coming out, all these Marvel movies were getting super popular, Guardians of the Galaxy was about to come out in theaters. And so Bendis took over the Guardians of the Galaxy comic book because they were going to do a huge push with Guardians and they wanted a lot of people to buy it, so they wanted a big writer on it. And so they pushed back his debut on Iron Man, which he was supposed to take over earlier because they wanted him to do Guardians. And then a couple of other movie-related things happened. He had a TV show that he was working on. And so the time he took over writing Iron Man was delayed. And I couldn't tell anyone because it's one of those sort of industry secrets. And I worked not in comic book, but in media. And so I felt really awkward telling people. So I just kept it quiet. I knew that Bendis was taking over Iron Man about a year before anybody else, publicly. And then when he announced he was taking it over – I got a note out of nowhere and said, this is happening. Send me all the pictures you have of Max as soon as possible. I need them like within the next day. And I was like, oh my, I ran in the other room. I'm like, they're actually going to put him in this comic. Like, this is a real thing. He wasn't lying to us to be nice. And I sent them like 50 photos, and Dave Marquez is the artist. And I made a joke with him online today, actually, about Max. Like, we still stay in touch. We send Bendis and Marquez our calendar every year. They sent a bunch of comics and a bunch of other care packages, you know, to us and check in on Max and stuff. So it's been a really awesome way to stay involved in that.
It's been interesting to watch how it's impacted the greater hemophilia and bleeding disorders community. It was a huge deal that we had one of our own kids is in a freaking Marvel comic. Like, that's an awesome thing. And that's why, you know, you and the family were pointed out, celebrated, pick your word, at NHF's annual meeting in the opening session a couple years ago, because we've just never had that kind of exposure. It's so hard, as you know, for us to get that level of exposure, because we're such a small niche population in a world full of unique, rare, interesting, but, you know, there's a lot of that kind of stuff out there, things. So what did you think about the community response once Iron Max was actually into the world?
Yeah, it was actually pretty interesting, because we ended up getting, we didn't get a lot of response from anyone when Max got into the comic book, because look, honestly, it's a big deal for us. We love superheroes and things, but it was, for people who didn't know our story, it was just, hey, look at this really cool kid. Well, it coincided over those 18 months, a lot happened. And at the time, Zoe decided to start her own charity, basically, at 8 years old, that she wanted to create a project to raise money for hemophilia. We decided to do a calendar. Zoe recruited a lot of her friends to take photographs of things they love, and we printed calendars, and we were selling them. So the combination of an 8-year-old girl running a charity to help her brother. Oh, by the way, her brother's a superhero in a comic book. And look, they're my kids, but I think you'll agree, you've met them. They're pretty adorable kids, and they're very telegenic. So we got some local TV play here in Philadelphia, and then the local TV play turned into a couple of local news stories. And then just so happened that a producer at NBC Nightly News lived in Philadelphia and saw the follow-up story about Iron Man. We had originally been on the local CBS station in Philly about just the calendars. And we told them, like, hey, by the way, in a couple of months, Max is going to be an Iron Man, so maybe you come back and we'll do that. And they did. And then when that story hit locally, it became a national story, and then it became international, and we're in Canada and all over. People all over the world wrote about Max. And that's when we found out, to be completely honest, that's when we first knew that HFA and NHF existed. And I was even a little overwhelmed, because we were getting so many media requests and stuff. When both groups reached out, Rich Pizzillo reached out and John Indens reached out to me, and I got so confused. I thought they were the same organization. I didn't know that HFA and NHF were separate groups. And I talked to both of them, and then, you know, through those conversations, I was like, wait, you guys don't work together. And like, well, we work together, but not really. We're not the same company or, you know, organization. And so that was my first experience with them. And they were both amazing and wonderful, and did brought us into those communities in ways that we never expected. And then going to those meetings, we went to NHF in Orlando for the first time. We went to HFA in Las Vegas. And just having people meet Max, he signed like 50 autographs. HFA bought a bunch of the comic book and gave them out to all the kids. And Max signed autographs. And little kids came up to him. And adults came up to him and said, you're my hero. You are a hero to me. And still that happens. Max comes in to these conferences, and there's adults, like teenage kids who love comic books and saw a kid like them. And I'm just sitting there like, he's changing people's lives. And just by being himself, and just by handling this with such maturity at 3, 4, and 5 years old, and turning it into a positive. And so it's not only changed our lives, I really genuinely believe it's helped people in the community. And it's, that's the most rewarding thing that I've ever seen personally, that a little boy who's just magnetic and you just want to be around him has turned what could have been a negative in his life into the most incredible positive.
And what do you think is repeatable from this experience? Like you said, things go viral in some way or another. It's out of your control. You need the right producer who so happens to live in the city, see the thing on the news, and there's the convergence of, you know, this young girl is starting a charity for her brother who's also in a Marvel comic. You know, there's a lot that's just kind of happenstance or good luck. But there's things that you've done and things you've learned, I'm sure, that are repeatable for other families who want to find a way to kind of get their story, the message of their of this community and of their family out in an impactful way that helps change others. Is there anything that you do or you could offer to families who are thinking along those lines?
Yeah, for sure. And I think this wouldn't have happened were it not for our community here where we live. And I think the best and sort of smartest thing that we did was when we started the calendar, we said, like, Zoe could go out and take all these pictures herself, or Max could take a couple, and we could print it and sell it door to door and make a couple $100 and have a nice little project for the summer or for the fall. But why not get 15, 20 kids to do it with you? And some of those kids were patients at CHOP. They're not hemophilia patients, but one of her friends had celiac, one had cancer and was treated at CHOP. And so there was a personal connection. And when we decided the first year, now we actually donate to HFA, NHF, and CHOP, but the first year we donated all of the proceeds to CHOP. And that really got our HTC involved. It got our community involved in a way that they didn't know. So now we were able to teach all of these kids that go to school with Max and all these kids that go to school with Zoe and their families what hemophilia is, what it's about, that Max isn't going to bleed all over them, that he just needs to be a little bit safer maybe than the other kids, that, you know, he is just a normal kid in school who's awesome. And so we allowed, we were able to sort of teach the community about what's going on with us, but in a positive way that they could get involved. And so that's what I would say is repeatable for other people, is getting your community involved, not the hemophilia community. They're already involved. Going to your events and doing the walks and stuff, everyone should do that stuff because it's awesome and it helps raise awareness. But what, and you and I have talked about this a lot, so I don't feel like I'm telling you, people listening may, but I don't feel like I'm telling you anything different than we've had conversations many times. We're great together. This community is amazing, and it's changed our lives. But it's getting the people not in the community to care, which is a difficult leap. And it's not easy. But you can do that by getting your neighbors involved, by getting, and not just in the walks, but getting them involved in sharing the story. You can call your local newspaper and you can say, hey, we're all going to this event. We're having a bowling thing and we raised $50. Well, guess what? That might get you on TV because they're always looking for heartwarming stories. Even if it's $50, it doesn't need to be thousands. It helps. Don't get me wrong. The more money you can raise, it helps. But you can do those kinds of things. Get to your local media. They are always looking for, especially around the holidays, but they're always looking for that tug the heartstrings type of story. And if you can get the word hemophilia or von Willebrand's or, you know, bleeding disorders on television or in the local newspaper, it is amazing the kind of reach that I didn't even know how many people still watch the news. Like, I'm on the internet every day and I'm like, nobody watches the news. It's like millions of people watch the news locally and nationally. And just the impact of the donations that came into us after Max was on TV, like that's doable. We weren't just on national TV. Like, we've been on local TV even more after that. We do a March Madness bracket, and any time that Max gets a Final Four team right, we donate $100 to CHOP, and we ask people to match that if they want, or $5 or $1. That got us on TV because it's just a cool thing, and because our local news wanted to do a March Madness story, and they thought, hey, what about this kid? He's doing something cool. It's just a really simple thing, but it worked.
Well, and I think a big point that you're making too is that the value of having hemophilia or von Willebrand's mentioned on television is huge. It doesn't even have to be the centerpiece of the story. If you or your kid is doing something awesome in the community, and and the kid happens to have this thing and it means this, but that's not the story. That's a huge win. It doesn't have to be a bleeding disorder-centric story to appeal to those who are looking to put stories on television and for it to have the ripple effect for our community that you're referring to. And I think that's also an important point, that we don't have to trump up a story related to bleeding disorders just to make it all bleeding disorder-y. That can be a piece of the story. It doesn't have to be the centerpiece.
Right, exactly. And look, ours is a little bit of a snowball rolling downhill. So, you know, it's easier for us to maybe get some of these. I have a lot of contacts in media and people, you know Max. And look, the other thing, and to be fair, not everyone's comfortable on television. I have a kid who is now 7 years old who is a TV star. I mean, he's hilarious and he's engaging and he answers questions right. We trained him for that. Don't just say yes, you know, respond back. And you have to give a little bit of training because people, when they're easy to work with, and kids are, you know, nervous, but when they're easy to work with and when they can really do a good job answering, it certainly helps the piece. But now we have people reaching out to us. I had a woman in New Jersey reach out, and I didn't even think about this from a fundraising standpoint, but she's having a birthday party, and it's a popular trend now, you know, in lieu of presents, donate to X, Y, and Z cause. And she happened to just Google hemophilia because a family member was recently diagnosed, and she wanted some information on it, found our Hearts for Hemophilia site, and looked it up and was like, well, I'm going to donate to them. And so she reached out to me, and I thought it'd be like 10 kids. I was like, this is awesome. She said she's inviting 90 kids, and she expects 75 to show up. It's like the largest birthday party ever for like a 7-year-old. And they're going to donate. You know, theoretically, I don't know how many people will do it, but she told me that in lieu of gifts, they want everyone to donate to us. So that's not even, I got my kid on TV, or I got my kid. That's a group of 75 people, which is really, you know, double it for parents and siblings and whatnot. So that's about 200 people who are going to get our magnets, get our calendars, get our little documentation about what is hemophilia, and all those people are going to go away feeling good that they donated to a charity, but they're also going to learn about us, and they're going to learn about the disease, which is really crucial, because it's not a million people or 10,000 people or whatever, but it's 200 people that we just got engaged, and now hopefully 10% of those stay engaged, and maybe they go to a walk, or maybe they say, hey, my cousin had this, I think, and now they become more part of the community, and they didn't even know.
Just with a couple minutes we have left here, let's actually talk a little more about Hearts for Hemophilia and Zoe. In the community, the quote unaffected sibling can often be a part of the family dynamic that's challenging for parents and families in general to navigate because the child with the bleeding disorder needs that much more attention and et cetera, et cetera. But you've mentioned how close they've always been, how Zoe has really taken on, she started a charity because of what her brother has. Can you just speak a little bit as a parent what it has been like to watch how not only has she not felt excluded in some way, but she has actually, you know, she was disappointed when her factor number wasn't lower. Like, she's so bought in and a part of the community. What's it been like as a dad to see that?
Yeah, I mean, like, how Max has responded to having hemophilia has been remarkable, but how Zoe has stepped up and done what she's done, not just for him, but for our community locally and for the bleeding disorder community, frankly, is the proudest moment as a parent I've ever had. This was her idea. This isn't one of those like, oh yeah, she does a lot of the work. I mean, I'm a graphic designer by trade for years. So I did the finished product, but if you go to our website, if you look at our logo, that's Zoe's handwriting. That's Zoe's logo. She drew it freehand. And then I scanned it in and made it into a digital file. She picks all the photos that goes in. She picks the photographers. She tells them what they have to, you know, the quality of photos. She's rejected some of her friends' photos and asked them to take better ones. She really is a project manager for this. The kids, both of them, go to diners and sit outside for hours and not only ask people to donate, but explain to them what hemophilia is and explain to them why we're doing what we're doing. The amount of work that two little kids put in is frankly remarkable. We wouldn't be where we are without the two of them. And honestly, like you said, there was a time, especially at the first two conferences, there were times where she felt like, I deserve to be up there too. You know, I think, you know, Max sat up with me while I spoke at one of the conferences, and it's Max's story. And I think once she found out she was a carrier, I think she felt more connected. But even before that, she was a little jealous of him. And then we sat down and I said, you know how Tony Stark has Pepper Potts? Like, Tony Stark's the face of the company, but Pepper Potts really runs it. And she said, yeah. I go, you're Pepper Potts. You run things. He's the face. We need a face. Max has got the greatest face that we could ever ask for. He's the face, but she does all the work. And there's a different kind of reward there. And she's learned that. And I think it's really going to help her in life. When she goes to apply for colleges, she's going to say, I know how to play guitar. I had great grades. Oh, by the way, I started a charity when I was 8. You know, and I think she's really going to own this. And she'll the things that she's learning now, most people don't learn at 10 years old. And I think it's going to help her certainly down the line.
It's remarkable. And she's as much a hero and an inspiration for anyone in the community. But I think in particular for those siblings who like her at times have felt, I should be up there. This something feels off. We can now point to Zoe as an example of, hey, if you wanna get involved, if you wanna try to take on some kind of initiative or something that connects you more to your sibling or feel more a part of this thing, here's an example of how you can do that in a pretty profound way. Last question I want to ask of you, Dan, is I know now that I believe you and your wife are responsible, at least in part, for the new families track at NHF next year. Can you give us a little information as to what that means?
Sure, yeah. Look, she's smarter than me, and she does a lot of great things. She actually infuses Max every day, or when he has his treatments, twice a week in our kitchen. And so this would not be possible without her. I have a tendency to do more of these more front-facing things. But she certainly is the backbone. It's almost like I'm the Max character in this, where I'm talking a lot and she's the one who actually does all the work. So she deserves more credit than me for what's been going on in our family. NHF reached out. I spoke on a panel this past year. As you mentioned before, we were sort of honored in Val's opening session 2 years ago. And so I just wanted to stay involved, and we became friendly with a lot of the people who are mainstays, you included, who are involved in some of these conferences in different ways and speaking. And they reached out and said, hey, you spoke on the New Families track this year. Would you have any interest in being a co-chair? And I was like, absolutely. I mean, it's a great opportunity. And the one cool thing for me at this past year is not just speaking, but we became friends with a lot of the people who we met at these conferences. We stay, whether it be Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, I talk to some of them more than I talk to my actual friends I grew up with, because they're going through the same stuff as us. Their kids, read Max's comic book. There's a kid in California who reads Max's comic book every night. And they posted a photo the other day and said, my favorite superhero, because he was wearing a Batman shirt. And I wrote back, my second favorite. And, just because, and I believe that. I love that kid. Honestly, I hope the best for them. And I think about them all the time. And they do with us, too. And that's because we met at the conference. So to have the opportunity to be a part of that and maybe to help build some of the sort of the programming to get these families connected is really exciting. I'm a little nervous. I don't really know what I have to do. But I guess I'll find out when I go down there. But it's pretty exciting to be involved in that.
Dan, thanks again for taking the time today to come on and sharing your family story. It's Max's story, Zoe's story, your family story. It's a great story. And a takeaway for me is, as you said, even if you're not a media-facing person, so to speak, the way that you can make such a big difference by just putting in kind of that hustle energy and having Zoe and Max standing outside diners just talking about hemophilia, making a contact with someone that now invites 200 people to a birthday party. There's so many ways that you can be an advocate, whether it's through media or not. And I appreciate you giving us insight into different ways that people can think about it. And we'll have links in all the program notes that you can check out. Hearts for Hemophilia. You can take a look at the original artwork from Zoe. And if you're inclined to, buy a calendar. So Dan, thank you. Appreciate your time, man.
No, thank you. And if anyone has any questions or anything, this is what's great about this community. Feel free to reach out and please link to direct, my email or whatever. I'm here hopefully to answer whatever and ask questions, because I certainly learn more from other people than I can help. But it's been really heartwarming. I appreciate you asking me to do this, because it's what we do. It's so important to us to be able to spread that and talk to people about it. It's the greatest thing.
Natalie.
Yes, Patrick.
What is your favorite country that starts with I-R-E-L?
Ireland.
Very good, Ireland. And did you know that Ireland is the home base for a company we call Shire, who happens to also be the exclusive sponsor of the Bloodstream podcast? Did you know that?
I did know that, because when we were in Ireland, they were just moving there.
Or they were building a new facility or
something.
Something
like that.
But we did see Shire on the news while we were in Ireland.
And we were like, Shire!
But you know what I'm even more excited about? Their continued support of the Bloodstream podcast. And for that, we say,
thank you, Shire.
Thank you, Dan, for coming on the Bloodstream podcast and sharing your thoughts and your perspectives with us. We'll have links in the program notes to Dan's social media presence and the various initiatives that his family's up to that he mentioned here on the podcast. You can find the links in the program notes. And with that, Natalie, we are closing up this puppy right here. Closing up this puppy? That's a weird expression. How do you close a puppy? We're on parting shots. Parting shots, that one last thought to leave the audience with, bleeding disorders related or otherwise, or as you like to call it.
I mean, my
the fun thing I get to say at the end, Natalie.
I know, but my mind just thinking about closing puppies, right?
I know.
But yeah, the fun thing I get to say at the end, it's my favorite part.
Natalie, what is your parting shot for episode 17?
My parting shot is a couple weeks ago, we got to go to the beach together and take a dip in the ocean, which is my absolute favorite thing.
You're burying the lead, but why do we do that?
To celebrate my birthday.
Yeah, happy recent birthday.
Thank you, thank you. And you know, if you want to send me birthday messages, hit up that mailbag that we are now reading.
Yes, good callback. Mailbag at bloodstreammedia.com. Send Natalie birthday messages because we're gonna read them.
But yeah, so it was just a nice reminder to do local things. You know, when you live by the ocean, you don't go to the ocean as much. If you come to Los Angeles on vacation, it's probably in your top five things to do. So I just, it's a nice reminder to, like, it really brought me a lot of joy to just go jump in the ocean. And
enjoying the things that are local to you. That's a really good, we can all do that.
Yeah.
We can probably all do a better job of that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm from Cleveland and I've never been to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Right. Exactly. I grew up in New York and people would be like, you ever been to? I'm like, no, sorry. I don't know. Why? Because it's right there. I don't know. I didn't go there because it's right there.
It's always available. So just, you know, it's fun to do the available things.
My parting shot for episode 17 is kind of a riff on this idea that hemophilia doesn't define me. So we're living through a period of palpable anxiety, a time during which the public interest is not always being served, as, at least as best it could. Hurricane Harvey, Hurricane Irma, Hurricane Maria, the shooter in Las Vegas, ongoing chest thumping with the North Korean dictator, hundreds of thousands of young people afraid of deportation, millions of seniors under threat to lose Medicaid, and black males continue to be incarcerated five times more often than white males. We got a lot going on. And we celebrate this idea that bleeding disorders don't define us. That's good. So allow me to encourage you then to use the advocacy skills that you have learned from being a member of the bleeding disorders community to throw your support behind other causes that you care about as well. Because the right side of justice needs all the help that it can get.
That's a beautiful parting shot.
And that is all for this episode. Check out bloodstreammedia.com and subscribe to the Ask the Expert Powering Through and Bloodline podcasts to hear all of Bloodstream Media's podcasts for the bleeding disorders community. And don't forget to check out and share The Factor Revolution. You can email us a Natalie birthday wish at mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. We check it constantly. It's insane. You'll also find Bloodstream on Facebook, facebook.com/bloodstreammedia, and on Twitter at bloodstreaminfo. I still do that Bill Burr impression every time. I don't know if anyone even knows what it is. This episode of the Bloodstream podcast was written by Patrick James Lynch and Natalie Lynch, produced by Patrick James Lynch, Ryan Geelan, Rob Bradford, Andrew Gall, Josh Bragg, Avra Friedman, Heather Robin, Colby Crow, and the Bloodstream podcast is edited by Mr. Andrew Gall. Special thanks to everyone at Believe Limited, the National Hemophilia Foundation, the Hemophilia Alliance, Entertainment to Effect Change, and of course, Shire. Thanks as well to Sit Down segment guest Dan Levy. Reminder to check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreampod.com for links and additional information about the various stories featured on this episode. My name is Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself.